The following Dharma talk was recorded in September 2013 in Excelsior Springs, Missouri. It is one of three recordings from the retreat called Awakening with Insight, Cultivating Concentration and Mindfulness, taught by Shyla Catherine. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your email sent to info@midamericadharma.org. The retreat teacher, Shyla Catherine, is the founder of Insight Meditation South Bay in Mountain View, California. She has practiced meditation since 1980 with more than 8 years of accumulated silent retreat experience. Shyla has authored two books, Focus and Fearless, A Meditator's Guide to States of Deep Joy, Calm, and Clarity, and Wisdom Wide and Deep, A Practical Handbook for Mastering Jhana and Vipassana. Find out more about Shyla at www.imsb.org.
So tonight I'd like to speak about the planning mind. And I want to begin with a Pali term called papancha. Papancha is the Pali term that's usually translated as conceptual proliferation or the diversifying tendencies of mind or discursive thought. It basically describes the wandering mind that wanders off into associations lost in trains of thought. It often manifests as the basic trap of planning, and it can build into a kind of anxiety based upon plans. Planning is one of the most common forms that restlessness takes, and it is perhaps the most persistent hindrance to concentration. The restlessness that we might experience in meditation might be physical, a kind of physical agitation in the body that makes it very difficult to sit still. Or more commonly, the restlessness we experience is mental. When our planning slides far beyond our practical need for preparation and into the realm of compulsive worry, then we're really dealing with this mental hindrance of restlessness. So how do we react when we discover that we're caught by a fantasy of a future that may never happen? Are you surprised sometimes to realize that you've just been lost in thought for however many seconds or minutes? What's your response? Are you embarrassed to admit it? Do you judge yourself for planning? Or do you find yourself indulging in that repetitive mental activity, a kind of rehearsing in the mind, trying desperately to perfect the plan? One ancient Tibetan master, Geshe Shawopa, said, "Do not rule over imaginary kingdoms of endlessly proliferating possibilities." We might find it reassuring that we're not the only ones who plan. Even hundreds of years ago, the ancient yogis in Tibet also faced restlessness and various proliferating possibilities in the mind. This is not a challenge that is unique to contemporary lifestyle, and it's not caused by the technological demands that we live with. It may be, though, that our lifestyle has exaggerated the hindrance of restlessness and expanded the technology associated with planning, perhaps even refined the skills that sustain fantasy, even to the point of entertaining ourselves with fantasy games, with creating virtual worlds for gaming. We have professional planners, certified planners, wedding planners, workshop organizers, financial planners, tour group leaders, meeting consultants, and various contractors that are basically hired as expert planners. Some of you might be professional planners. But with so many aspects of our existence carefully scheduled and meticulously planned, it's easy to miss the simplicity and the vibrancy of the present moment, of this breath, of a calm and steady attention that is not leaning toward anything in the future, but is simply responsive and flexible with the moment as it is. It's useful sometimes to recognize the planning mind and to investigate it, to not just dismiss it and immediately come back to our present experience of sitting and breathing, but to sometimes notice, what is this planning tendency? Perhaps it's based on a desire to control, to imagine, and to try to create imagined scenarios so that we will not be surprised, caught off guard, or caught unprepared. But do we really want to live with no surprises? Do we really need to prepare ourselves for every possible occurrence? And so when we work with planning, the first thing we do is to notice, to become aware that we're planning when we're planning. And to notice if we're stuck in the planning mode. Have we been seduced by the content? Are we desiring something that's not real? Or can we shift our attention as soon as we notice that we're planning to other activities, to other objects, to other perceptions, or just come back to the feeling of the next breath, to observe the mood in the mind, the sensations in the body. Basically, we're asking, how seduced are we? Do we find the mind ricocheting right back to the planning scenarios? Or are we able to pretty easily untangle it and settle again on the breath or whatever's happening in the present moment? It seems perhaps like planning could be very useful, you know, a pragmatic strategy in life. But as we observe the planning process, we might be surprised at how often our plans are simply useless. A lot of planning is not preparation for action. It's merely the manifestation of restlessness, fear, and anxiety. It's the movement of a mind that doesn't know how to rest and doesn't trust ourselves to respond to things as they actually occur. The usefulness of planning must be assessed on a case-by-case basis. Are you actually preparing for something that might really happen? Or is planning separating you from a vivid experience that is real right now? How effective is your planning? And how many times have you planned that same event? If planning is a common hindrance for you, you might start to count them. Say you're planning some conversation or some event. Just count. How many times have you planned it? How many times each time you plan it? Oh, 1. 10 minutes later in the meditation. Oh, 2. Oh, 5 minutes later. Oh, 3, and the mind keeps bouncing back, replanning it. Now, sometimes you're perfecting the plan and you're changing the outcome or the ending, or you're doing things a little bit different in your imagination to see how it might turn out. But I very much appreciated the advice of one of my teachers when he said, if I think a thought 5 times and I'm not learning anything new from it, I don't think it anymore. And I do think there's value in gaining some control over the restless mind. It's not that we have to control our mind, but we don't have to be at the beck and call of every thought. There can be a practical, disciplined relationship to our thoughts. In the context of a retreat, I often, when I enter into personal retreat, I enter in with the resolve to make no plans. And then I remind myself of that resolve. I especially don't want to plan my meditation. I want to discover something genuine, a genuine experience, and not just have the experience that I've already anticipated or imagined, or be disappointed that my experience didn't conform to my expectations. One of the problems with planning is that it does not recognize the characteristics of impermanence, anicca, of unsatisfactoriness, dukkha, and of the not-self characteristic of things, anatta. Planning disguises these characteristics of experience, and these are the liberating characteristics of experience. For example, planning can mask the truth of anicca, impermanence. Through planning, we might try to cling to a concept of the future and divorce ourselves from the truth of change. We imagine what's happening now will continue to happen in the future. We forget that it's just arising and perishing moment by moment. Planning the future can be seductive because we might think we can control the outcome if only we can plan it well enough to account for all the various options. Then we'll somehow be safe. But planning very easily gets out of hand, and we might find that we're not only planning projects that need a certain degree of preparation, but we're planning impossible scenarios such as, what will I do with the whole rest of my life? Or we're planning what will happen in the next meditation. You never know what's going to happen in the next meditation. That's not preparation. Instead, it might just be an attempt to control what's unfamiliar, what's unknown. These fantasies of what might happen, what will happen, does not acknowledge the constantly changing sequence of events, anicca. If we're attached to our plans, we might insist that our experience conform to our expectations, even when conditions have changed, and we'll feel quite out of alignment with reality. We might become inflexible and stuck and feel distant from things. Or we might just be disappointed that things didn't turn out the way we wanted them to. They might have turned out just fine, but many times if we enter into something, any event, but a retreat in particular, with plans, then we almost always leave disappointed for the simple reason that nothing usually happens the way that we've planned in the spiritual life, in the meditative life. So expectations almost inevitably lead to disappointment. And then while we're expecting a certain kind of future, a future that never quite turns out that way, we're missing the wonder of what's actually happening now. We're not noticing the constantly changing, the arising and passing of all things, of mind, of matter, of perceptions, of sensations, of sounds, of experiences internally and externally. We're not giving ourselves the chance to have the liberating insight into impermanence. But planning also disguises the dimension of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness. Planning, especially in the form of planning fantasies, distract us perhaps from a present unpleasant sensation. It might be a feeling of pain or irritation in the body. It might be an emotional state of sadness, of grief, of fear. People do a great deal to protect themselves from feeling certain feelings, and we do a disservice to ourselves when we don't allow ourselves to have the feelings that we're having. What do you do to avoid ever feeling sad or lonely? What comforts do you surround yourself with to avoid even a momentary unpleasant sight or smell or taste or contact? There tends to be a deeply conditioned unwillingness to open to the first noble truth, that there is suffering, that there is unsatisfactoriness in all conditioned things. This unwillingness drives us to plan ever more creative ways of avoiding unpleasant phenomena to secure our comfort. But it's only through the full understanding of dukkha that we will be liberated from suffering. We'll not be liberated by avoiding it. So when planning seems to get a bit obsessive, there's a simple technique, and it's simply to pause, to interrupt the cycle of distraction, and just pause. Turn your attention to your own experience as it's happening. Take a breath. Consciously notice that this is restlessness. Restlessness is dukkha. Investigate this experience of unsatisfactoriness. Bring interest to this. Ask yourself, is there something here that I'm not feeling, that I don't want to open to? And see if you might be able to open to that unpleasant sensation or feeling or thought. Directly feeling the unpleasant experiences usually bring much greater peace and happiness than obsessively planning ways to avoid feeling them. All conditioned experiences are unsatisfactory. They're not necessarily terrible, awful, impossibly agonizing things. Often they're just unsatisfactory. And they're unsatisfactory simply because the conditioned processes of mind and body simply will never be a basis for our lasting happiness. When we don't recognize this and we keep seeking happiness in places it can never be found, we fuel the fear. The fear of feeling dukkha can lead us into deeper and more complex plans just trying to avoid this basic fact of life. But no plan can avoid dukkha. No plan can avoid pain, aging, sickness, and death. At some point, we must turn our attention to it and be willing to know suffering in the present moment, in our lives, however it might manifest. Planning also might disguise the characteristic of anatta, not self. And you might just consider how many of your plans revolve around your own self-image, perhaps how you'll appear to others, how you'll succeed, what you'll say. Often people try to construct a clear sense of self through imagining our futures, imagining our identities, fabricating the new me. I'll say this, I'll appear like this, I will become that. We create ourselves anew through repeating a story of self to ourselves. And even though it's a fiction, it might seem to provide a strange sense of being someone, a confirmation that we're going somewhere, that we're important, and that our future is predictable, is controllable, is assured. But I assure you, your future is not assured. Nothing is. Can we be okay with that truth? Obsessively thinking about our future is a futile attempt to create a sense of security and identity. In the end, it leaves us only with a shallow tale, with the story of our own lives that we have imagined. When we're caught by the story, we become a mere character in a drama, disconnected from the vitality of our lived present life. So how do we work with obsessive planning? Well, first, we become mindful of it. Before we can successfully set it aside, we must recognize it. And I think get used to it. Have a sense of humor about it, a friendliness toward it. Not an indulgence in it, but a kind regard, simply because restlessness is one of those fetters that is not abandoned until the final stage, the fourth stage of enlightenment. It's possible it could be around for a while. So there's no point in beating ourselves up for around it. We simply learn how to work with it. It can erupt even in peaceful conditions, like on a retreat, when we actually don't have anything that we need to do that needs planning. I mean, really, what do you have to plan? What you're going to wear tomorrow? Where you're going to do your walking meditation? What time you're going to have a cup of tea? I mean, seriously, you don't have to plan anything. You can just follow the schedule. Wake up when the bell rings, and follow the schedule, sitting and walking through the day. So essentially, when planning arises, we recognize it, we know it, we might even name it, this is restlessness, this is planning. We don't need to judge ourselves for thinking, but we can resolve to return to present awareness with a commitment to make no plans, to actually connect with the present sensations as they're happening, so that we don't just come back toward the present moment. We connect with the present moment as it's actually happening. But sometimes we're going to need to explore the feelings that are fueling the emotions that are underneath the chronic planning mind. It's very possible that some discomfort, anxiety, insecurity, and fear are linked with obsessive worry or planning. Can we open to that layer of experience, that discomfort with uncertainty, with not knowing what will be, to recognizing that we're actually not in control of the future? Can we feel what happens in our minds as we plan? Often we'll feel a stiffness, an inflexibility, a sense of being driven or contracted. And we might even feel tired sometimes of planning, because it takes a great deal of effort to imagine and structure and then sustain an imagined future. As we observe the mind as it's planning, we can understand how it is we get seduced by a fantasy of our own future. Because we can plan almost anything, as grand as our whole lives or as useless as what other people might say to us. It could be planning mundane things, like a shopping list or what we'll pack for our next retreat, or as spiritual as what will happen when we enter a deep concentration state or when we're enlightened. Have you ever bought a lottery ticket? Now, that's an experience of fantasy, if you do. If you ever look at the statistics, there's no chance. And yet many people do buy lottery tickets in order to sustain the fantasy, to have a chance at those $22 million or whatever the jackpot might be. And it can be very interesting to notice that sometimes one goes to buy a lottery ticket and has already planned how to spend the $22 million long before one has, the numbers have even been drawn, let alone one has realized that one has not won. It's very common for people to plan insights on their retreats. This retreat will be my impermanence retreat. And I think I'll do another retreat next summer, and that one I'll focus on not self, have experiences of emptiness. And I think in between I might explore a little bit of some concentration practice and maybe get into jhana. And then somebody comes to a jhana retreat, and there are four jhanas. It's a 10-day retreat, 1 day to warm up, 2 days for the first jhana, 2 days for the second jhana, 2 days for the third jhana, 2 days for the fourth jhana, and integration. Got it. And then the retreat starts to unfold, and it doesn't quite happen as planned. The planning of our retreats might not be that explicit, but anytime we're comparing ourselves to signposts of progress, we actually do have a plan that we might not have acknowledged. One of my teachers passed out a map, one could say, of the progress of the development of the practice of tranquility and insight. And it included the various jhanas and then the various discernments and the various insights through the 16 knowledges. And at the pinnacle of the peak of this progress was the realization of Nibbana. So he handed this paper on the first day of the retreat, and some people actually have the thought, this is what I'm going to learn on this retreat. This is what I'm going to experience on this retreat, and start thinking, okay, so I have this many days or weeks for this level, and then this one, and then this one, and then this one. But the Dharma unfolds in its own way and in its own time. One of the most useless things people plan is conversations. Have you ever planned a conversation? Has it ever turned out the way you planned? Did you ever remember to say what you were going to say? And did you ever accurately predict what the other person was going to say? If you're really good, you might have gotten the first few words out right. And then it's all up for grabs. The most we can really do is be present. And yet, even knowing that, often we do it again. We plan another conversation and then another one and another one, forgetting how utterly useless it is. The tendency is when something is happening and it's pleasant and we're not mindful that it's pleasant, the tendency is to plan how we can get more of it. And when something is happening that's unpleasant and we're not mindful that it's unpleasant, then we plan how to get less of it, how to avoid it, how to move away from it, how to get rid of it, how to overcome it, how to distract ourselves from it. The detail ability of the obsessive mind is quite amazing. We can plan things in intricate detail. If our concentration starts to get strong and we're really, really with each moment just as it is, and we recognize, wow, my concentration is really strong, we might jump ahead of ourselves with our plans and start to develop concepts, ideas about entering into the absorption states of jhana. We might not even be using an object for our meditation that's suitable for jhana, but nevertheless, we got the idea of concentration. And so the mind leaps ahead with plans as to what that state's going to be like and how we're going to enter it and what we're going to do when we get out of it and how that's going to influence the rest of our lives. If we're having a really good retreat, we might start to plan going to Asia and finding a nice little cave where we can plan, where we can sit for 2 months, or wondering if we can still get into the 3-month retreat in Bari. Maybe there's a slot open. Maybe it's not too late. But then a couple of hours later, we're tired. Maybe we ate pasta at lunch and it sunk our energy a bit, and then we start to dream about packing and going home because we're so dull, we're not accomplishing anything, and all those great plans for cave practice are just never going to happen now, and so we want to give up. Then, after we get really tired of planning what our spiritual life is going to be like, and our material life, then we start working on our family, what our spouse should be doing, and how they should improve themselves. And then we start working on our children or our parents. And you know how effective that ever has been, right? If you've ever tried to change a child or a parent, impossible. So I think it can be interesting to notice when the mind has strayed into planning that even the mind knows is impossible, like planning somebody else's life or what somebody else should do. At that point, we just have to laugh. We just have to have a good laugh, set it aside, and start again. Be willing to just begin again, afresh. It can be interesting to notice sometimes what the root tendencies are underneath planning. Are those basic roots, are they the forces of greed, of hatred, or of delusion? Sometimes desire fuels the obsession when we find ourselves planning what we're going to cook, what we're going to get, what we're going to keep, what we're going to preserve, what we're going to shop for. Or romantic or sexual fantasies. Basically, anything about what I want is often rooted in greed. If we find the mind rehearsing little snide remarks that we're going to make the next time somebody says something, or revenge scenarios, or justifying ways that we should bear this, hold a grudge against somebody and why we have a right to be angry, that's probably rooted in aversion, in anger, or in ill will. And fantasies about how we'll present ourselves, about our image, our self-image, is rooted in delusion. What we'll say, how we'll be seen, what we'll wear, will others like us? Will they love us? Will they recognize us? But all of it is just planning dukkha. And when I notice the planning dukkha, I often call it that. I label it planning dukkha. I highlight the dukkha that's inherent in planning, the suffering that comes with this process, this mind state. When I notice the dukkha of planning, I inevitably notice a kind of contraction, a grasping, and that grasping is suffering. In the planning, there is craving, craving for something that is not present. Even if it's based in ill will or delusion, there's craving the self-recognition, or there's craving the absence of the painful situation. Seeing it as dukkha is seeing the danger in restlessness, and it is directly working with the first and second noble truth, knowing the truth of suffering and abandoning the causes of suffering. This makes it Dhamma practice. As soon as we start to see planning as dukkha, we've brought that planning mind right into the heart of a liberating practice. But I don't want you to think that planning should always be avoided, because some things need to be planned. First of all, none of you would be here if planning didn't happen, right? Somebody had to plan this retreat. We started planning this retreat, what, a year and a half before the retreat? I think I put it on my calendar. I'm now planning retreats for 2014 and 2015. They don't happen otherwise. They just don't happen. The organizers had to hire the facility. They had to get on their calendar. They had to organize the publicity, plan how to communicate it to you. And each one of you had to plan to get the time off work, make plans with family to have your cats fed, or your children got taken to school and back, or whatever you have to do in your life to make plans. Many professions require an enormous amount of planning, strategies, and protocols. Emergency response workers, nurses, paramedics work under very clear protocols. Some years ago, I read a little blurb in a magazine that said that 3,000 cars run out of gas driving across the San Francisco Bay Bridge. Now, some of you who've been across that bridge might have a spot in your heart for this bridge. But even if you've never driven across that bridge, it's just a bridge. It's just a stretch, you know, going across water. 3,000 cars, 3,000 people didn't plan to have enough gas when they entered the bridge to get across it. To me, that's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. Some things really need to be planned. When we get in a car, we have to make sure that we have prepared ourselves to get where we're going to go for the things that we can do. Okay, if we get a flat tire on the bridge, That's beyond our control, but we can put the gas in the tank. If you want to eat at home, you have to plan your meals. You have to buy the food. You have to allow enough time to chop the vegetables and to cook them up and to wash the dishes. It doesn't happen automatically. Arts, theater, dance requires a great deal of planning, rehearsals, lighting design, choreography. The directors have to block out everything and script everything. All the exits and entrances of the actors have to be carefully planned so that they don't trip over each other. And when it's planned and practiced, it can be beautiful. It's also useful to plan, to set goals, to having a financial plan, a personal financial plan is responsible. It doesn't mean we can control the stock market, but we might still have something of a financial plan. You can tell I like to plan what I'm going to say, right? How many pages do I have here? I'm up to page 13. Now, much of what I have said is written on here, but not everything. And some of it's in type, and about, probably about half of it at this point is in pencil of little scribbles where different ideas change. And I have something else I want to say. But I do like to plan what I'm going to teach. I like to plan what I'm going to talk about. I like to do that because then I spend more time thinking about it. And I think that way I tend to give fuller talks and address the teachings to a wider array of people rather than just that one direction that my mind is thinking about, you know, like right now. But even this, I wasn't sure what I was going to talk about until just before dinner. I was debating between three different topics. So even when we plan something, there still is a little wiggle room that we can give ourselves. And when we do plan things, I think we have to give ourselves that wiggle room. And we can plan things, but in small measures, near time frames. And then we can stop ourselves when our plans start to get way too far ahead. For example, well, I have to admit I'm a good planner, and this is one of my favorite hindrances. If my mind is going to wander off somewhere, it's very likely going to wander off into a plan. So I've worked a lot with this hindrance, and I remember sitting on a retreat, and it was approaching the end of a very long retreat. And I had scheduled teaching for right after I came out of the retreat. And I had been away. Well, it wasn't very long. It was a few months. So I was in retreat for, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 months. I'm not sure now. But I remember I was going to come out and teach pretty quick. And so my mind, as I approached the end of the retreat, started planning teaching. But as soon as I thought, oh, I'm going to have to be teaching soon, I didn't start planning what I was going to be teaching 2 days after going home. No. What did my mind want to do? But plan what I was going to teach 2 years from now. One of those retreats that was on my calendar for 2 years from now, I start thinking, oh, this experience that I had on retreat would make a really good talk for that community. I'll structure it this way and this way and use this as an example. And I realize, wow, I'm planning something way, way, way far out there. Maybe I could drop those plans And if I had to plan something, at least plan the first thing that I was going to have to teach. That was just in a few days' time. We also can acknowledge that we are thinking. If we decide to consciously plan something, to do it consciously, to do it mindfully, to be aware that we're engaged in a thought process of planning. When we're aware that we're planning, we tend to just plan what needs to be planned. We tend to plan it fairly well and to do it once. Often the repetitive planning happens because we're not aware that we're planning. And then in the course of the plan, I think we have to acknowledge that we still don't know what's actually going to happen. Anything can change. It's all uncertain. And so even though we might plan something, we have to be flexible and willing to drop the best laid plans and to develop equanimity with whatever results come out of those actions. While we're on retreat, we can work with this. Even though there's not a lot that we need to plan, we still do make a few choices and there are still a few events. So we can watch the mind. For example, I asked you all to try to sit a couple of extra hours in addition to the scheduled sittings. Well, how are you going to do that? Are you going to plan to wake up early? Are you going to plan to stay up late? Are you going to plan to use that more than 2 hours after the lunch break? Are you going to just see how you feel and respond to the moment? How are you going to get in 2 extra hours? Are you going to say, well, that sounds nice, fine for her to say, but I'm not going to sit any longer. My knees are killing me. My back's killing me. But maybe I can get in a reclining meditation and just try not to fall asleep. So I'll go lay down on my bed. You know, that actually can work. I often do that and I decide if it's during the daytime, I decide, well, I'm going to do reclining meditation on the bed, but I don't put the blanket over me. I don't curl up. I take up a reclining posture that rests my back, but is not the same position I would sleep in. I let myself be just a little bit cold, because I usually sleep under a blanket and I'm warm and cozy. Or I lift my arm up or I put my knees up. I do something to help myself make it into a meditation and I let my back rest. And I'll often do that after the lunch period. And then I just choose. I have the clear intention of whether or not I'm going to use that as a meditation time or whether I'm going to use it as a sleep time. But I have to admit, for me, this rarely works in the morning. I'm not much of a morning person, but usually in the morning, I have to get up and out of bed. Otherwise, I'll roll over or fall asleep. So you can do that. You can plan how you're gonna get in a little bit more meditation time based upon your own rhythms of the day when you have the energy. Maybe you'll want to do extra walking meditation instead of sitting. But imagine maybe you sign up for an interview. And in the sitting before the interview, what's happening in the mind? Are you planning what you're going to say, what you're going to ask? I think it is valuable to do a little bit of preparation before an interview. It's simply to reflect upon what your experience of the meditation is. To ask yourself a couple of questions, such as, do I have any questions? If so, it's helpful to know what they are. Ask yourself, what is the quality of the last couple of meditations? Usually it's not helpful in an interview to start to tell me what's happened since you began meditating X number of years ago. It's usually more helpful to tell me you've been meditating for X number of years and then this is what's happening now. Unless something happened in the past that is really significant and you need to tell me a past story, for the most part, it's helpful just to reflect on what's been happening in the last few sittings or whatever feels like it characterizes your current experience. And then to consider if there's any particular hindrances that you're struggling with, or if there's anything that's kind of insightful and intriguing and a new opening. Because an interview can be used not only to develop skills to work with difficulties, it can be used to help deepen insights or to help understand just what happens to be unfolding in the present. But whatever we do plan, so much is utterly beyond our control, beyond what we could conceive of, and beyond what we could ever have planned for. Sometimes we discover that our plans are foiled again and again, and this is a good thing. When we see that planning is so often ineffective, we might be willing to drop the plans and open to an experience of simple humility, of presence, and of faith that we can be with our own experience as it occurs. We don't have to prepare for everything. With our plans thwarted, we're reminded again of anicca, things are impermanent, of dukkha, conditioned phenomena is unsatisfactory, and anatta, it's not self. Between our plans and our projections, beyond our thoughts, we might discover something more wondrous and fresh than anything we could ever have anticipated. I'd like to end with one of my favorite verses from the Middle-Length Discourses. Let me not revive the past, nor on the future build my hopes, for the past has been left behind, and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let me see each presently arisen state. Let me know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. Today the effort must be made. Tomorrow death may come, who knows? No bargain with mortality can keep him and his hordes away. But one who dwells thus ardently, relentlessly, by day, by night. It is she, the peaceful sage, has said, who has had a single excellent night.